Hello and welcome to a new English edition of my podcast Helium Talk, Das Kunstgespräch. My name is Jörg Heikhaus and today you are listening to my conversation with John Bergemann. John and I go a while back. I showed him at the Helium Cowboy Gallery in Hamburg for the first time in 2008 and we did a couple of exhibitions together for a few years after. We once went to New York together to make a very special booth at the Scope Art Fair. I think it was in 2009 and we more or less did a performance for 5 days. To me, this is legendary and there's still a video out there somewhere on YouTube, I believe. I will put the link into the show notes if I can find it. Basically, we created a research laboratory environment from cardboard and found objects. It was called the Lossy Data Lab and for the whole duration of the fair we stayed in character, me and our intern Ollie Johns as lab assistants, John as the head researcher. And research we did. It was very interactive. We had questionnaires for the visitors, we made up charts and test equipment. John did very creative and individual tests with the people daring to take part and drew works from their mind streams, so to say. It was great fun, but also pretty tough, just because running this and acting for 5 days was very tiring. We sold the results at the booth, the drawings John created or the machines he built from cardboard. But it was 2009 and it was only months after the Lehman Brothers had burned all their money and dragged the world into a very heavy financial crisis. So there weren't many people left buying art back then and that was one of the reasons why we did a special project rather than an ordinary art fair booth. That way we wouldn't have sold much work anyway, so I thought fuck it, let's do something experimental, interactive and much more exciting. And who could have been better for this than the great entertainer and master doodler John Bergemann. That lab was wonderful. We recreated it in a different way again in Hamburg later on as the Lossy Botany Lab. Different kind of research though. Anyway, John Bergemann is known for his unique, witty and instantly recognizable illustrations. He moved from England to New York some years ago, where I reached him at his studio for this episode. We talk about how he got to the Big Apple, how he copes with the demands of the art world, and we also talk about football because that is a huge thing for both of us and part of our friendship. Well, I hope you enjoy this show. At the end, there will be music again because John has a band together with Jim Avion that is called Anxiety Team, and he gave me a song for this podcast. He also sent me an image of the drawing he made during our conversation, and that is up on my Instagram account at Helium Cowboy. So, as always, I'm very happy to receive your feedback, get mails, comments, reviews, and ratings for Helium Talk. Please also subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss a show and tell your friends they should listen to this also. And now, John Bergemann. Didn't you do an exhibition once, which was called Because I Can't Sit Still?
That is true. Wow. That is some good research.
I think for me, it's common knowledge. Oh, okay. Yeah, you know, I mean, knowing you for such a long time and following you around a little bit. And but so this will be hard for you now for like 60 minutes.
Sitting. Yeah, I mean, I might have to wriggle. I mean, I have got a piece of paper and a pen in front of me now. Of course. You shouldn't be able to hear it. I mean, it would be impossible literally do nothing.
Can you send me a picture of what you've been drawing?
I mean, I will. It's a blank page at the moment. Let's see what happens.
And you're in your studio right now in New York?
Yeah, my studio is in Greenpoint in Brooklyn. Okay. And it's a 20-minute walk from my apartment to the studio, which is very nice.
So how's New York treating you?
I think New York is relatively indifferent to anyone that comes to visit her. She, you can have a good time in New York if you want, but it can be tough as well. It doesn't really care. Lots of great people come to New York, so if you can't hack it, you just get booted out and someone else will take your space very happily. but yeah, I'm having a good time here.
When did you move to New York? It's a couple of years ago, right?
Yeah, more than a couple. I think I moved at the end of 2010.
Yeah.
So about like 9 years ago, I guess, or thereabouts. Before I would try a new thing by living in a new place in a new country.
Did you ever think it would, you know, it would fascinate you long enough, so long? I mean, so many years.
No, I had no idea I would stay. I mean, the thing is, I moved here with no idea. So I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know how long I would live here, whether I would stay in this city or go to another city or go to another country. I like to tell people I came here to retire. So I didn't really want to do any work or anything. I just have a good time. And then after like a week or two, I realized that I wouldn't be able to afford to retire here. So
pretty expensive town.
Yeah. Quite expensive. Started renting an apartment and all that kind of thing. And it's, I used to live in Nottingham in the middle of the UK. So it's quite a big hike in sort of cost of living compared to there. But, you have all these other distractions and benefits and things to entertain yourself with. So it's a good trade-off, but yeah, it keeps you on your toes, I would say.
I think the first time you were in New York, you were meeting with Jim Avion and at what was the gallery called? Factory Fresh.
That's right. I mean, that wasn't my first time visiting.
No, but the first exhibition you did, right?
Yeah, one of them. I mean, I knew the guys from Factory Fresh, Scooville, and Pufferella from before they had that space. They had the first street art gallery in New York on Orchard Street. And sadly, it kind of closed down just as street art was becoming a lucrative global phenomenon. So that they were a bit of ahead of the curve. And then they relocated to Bushwick in Brooklyn, which, again, ahead of the curve. That was a bit of a rough and tumble neighborhood, which didn't have very much going on. And now, of course, there are major galleries there, and it's a trendy place to live. And sadly, their gallery's not there anymore. So we've got to keep an eye on whatever they're going to do next, because we just, 10 years later, all the property will be worth a lot more. I had they offered me a solo show in their gallery, and it's quite a big space. It was like an old sort of grocery store or something they converted into a gallery. And I said, can I share the exhibition with someone else? And they said, sure, who do you have in mind? And I emailed Jim, someone I'd never met before, never shown work with, but someone whose work I really liked. And I had no idea he lived in New York. So it kind of all aligned. He said yes to a complete stranger emailing him saying, do you want to have a show together? And then he said, I'll go and check out the space. I live nearby. And I was like, what, really? So yeah, it worked out well. And then we met. And the first day we met was a week before the show opened, and we started painting and making work together. And it was a start of a good friendship and collaboration.
Yeah, I think this, I mean, the two of you met because I knew Jim before as mm-hmm. well. I've had done shows with him here in Hamburg. And he's a super, super nice and super friendly guy, but sort of you guys were like a match made in heaven. if you allow me to say in this way.
I don't know if it was always heaven, but it was certainly a good match. And I really enjoyed working with Jim. It was always fun. I knew we would get on well when we were talking about like how we display the work in the gallery. And mm-hmm. he said, oh, we'll just put it up with tape. Yep. Tape it to the wall. And I thought, this is my kind of guy. Yeah. Like every other artist is all, we've got to have these special hooks. And Jim, just stick it on the wall. I was like, yes, finally someone who doesn't care about this stuff in the same way that I do. And just cares about making stuff, making lots of stuff. And then he was like, do you want to make music? Do you want to do a performance? I was like, okay, why not? Why not? Why the hell not? So we did. Yeah.
You played together and the combo was called Anxiety Team, right? Was it already right. at the first exhibition that you started it?
No. So we did a live painting performance at the first exhibition, which my younger brother was the DJ for. So he was playing music and we were painting along with the music, and that was good fun. And then at the closing exhibition, like a party, I wasn't in New York at that time, and Jim, who has been playing music for over 20 years, wanted to do a musical performance. Because I couldn't be there, he sent me some music or something. He said, why don't you say something over the top of the music, or and we'll record it and I'll play it so it can sound as if you're there. So we did that. And then he was a little bit annoyed, because he said at the end of that performance, people kept coming up to him saying, who was that voice? That voice was so nice. Who was that? And he was like, oh, it's John. So next time we met up.
I was there, John. I was there when you performed the Factory Fresh. Yeah, yeah.
I wasn't even at that gig.
Yeah, no, you weren't even at the gig. Yeah.
So after that, he was like, friends. Yeah, that's so funny. he was like, maybe we should do more of this. I was a little unsure, but we started doing this thing via email. So he'd send me a little bit of music and I'd come up with some funny words and sort of, I wouldn't really call it singing, and sort of talk over the top of it. And he's very good at this. He could like take what I'd sent him and chop it up and make it fit. And he would add, you know, embellish it a bit with more music. And then I would add some more lyrics. And we did this back and forth, and we came up with some stuff that was kind of catchy. And then I thought, all right, I'll come back to New York. And I came for a whole summer. And that's when the band started. So I guess that was the summer of 2010. I was in LA for a little bit for an exhibition. And then I went from LA to New York, and I stayed in New York for a couple of months and like rented a room somewhere in Brooklyn. And almost every day I'd go and meet up with Jim, and we'd make paintings and paste stuff up on the street and record songs and eat burritos. And it was a really, really fun time. And yeah, by the end of that summer, we'd performed a couple of gigs, which to me was a big deal, because I'd never done anything like that before. So it's kind of crazy. It was good fun. It was really good fun.
Yeah, sure. You actually played together at the Golden Poodle Club here in Hamburg, which is a legendary place. I mean, famous musicians have played there. And I remember that was during an exhibition that Jim did at the gallery that I once had at the train station. And I remember that you've been super nervous, and I think you fought it with a lot of alcohol that evening. Right, and that was a fantastic show. That was a really good show.
Yeah.
Oh, you played the ukulele for the first time, right? Something like that.
Maybe. I mean, yeah. So with the band, I started to learn how to play the ukulele very badly, and we played the Golden Poodle a couple of times. Gee, I kind of forgotten about all this. Yeah. I mean, the good thing with Jim knew all these venues, especially in Germany. So we played in lots of great places that I feel we would. Personally, I was not qualified to play in, and they were wonderful experiences. I was always very nervous before every gig, but like a song or two in, it would normally calm down. A bit like I liken it to going on a flight and being nervous as it takes off, and it's a bit bumpy. But then, so you when you hit cruising altitude, you kind of a bit more chilled out. And can relax a little bit more, and that's kind of how I felt with the gigs. If the crowd were nice to us and didn't boo us off after a couple of songs, then I knew we'd be okay. But we had some really fun times doing it. I remember once in Switzerland, we played a gig, and it was kind of typically kind of half empty by the time we started, and the venue was kind of full by the time we ended. So much so that we played the gig again. Everyone was like, you know, keep going, we're having a good time now. So we sort of did the whole set twice in a row, which is kind of bizarre, but yeah, there was good energy with those things.
You're still playing together from time to time, or still making
not
music?
Not really. He moved back to Berlin, so, and that was like 4 or 5 years ago now. That kind of ended the band, sadly, because we'd started off doing it via email, and then we were basically next door neighbors. I mean, I managed to get an apartment 2 blocks away from him, so it was really convenient. And then sort of going back to doing it by email again, and him not being, you know, not being in New York to do gigs, and me not being in Europe to easily get to Germany and stuff, it was too much. So sadly, the band kind of came to an end. And that's when I started to look for a studio space again and, you know, resume doing my drawings and paintings with a little bit more seriousness, I guess.
You were starting to do art shows? I mean, I think you've gotten in contact with a bunch of New York artists or people from the New York art scene, like Laurie Zimmer and what's her friend again? Laurie and super famous stencil artist, come on.
Oh, Logan.
Logan Hicks, yeah.
Logan Hicks, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I think I met Laurie in one of my first weeks in New York. I went to someone's house party, and maybe she was the roommate of the person's party or a good friend, but I met her quite early on. Really, really like Laurie. She's brilliant. I started to know people in New York and start to do more shows and get involved in events and things. I mean, Laurie came to some of the Anxiety and gigs. I mean, she's been a really kind supporter of all the goofy things I've done. And this time last year, we had a little pop-up show together at Scope Art that she created that I showed my work in. So, yeah, we've done lots of stuff together.
And did you do, I mean, did you art exhibitions in New York again? Because I remember, the last exhibition that we did together was in 2010 here in Hamburg.
Right.
We did a Lossy Data Lab in New York at Scope as well, I think, definitely. In 2009. And then 2010, the Lossy Botany Lab in Hamburg, right?
Oh, yeah. I was wondering when we last saw each other. I've been doing
It's been a while.
It has been a while. I've been doing stuff, do some stuff here, and I guess my last shows of significance or of a certain size have been in Asia. So I've done a few shows in Korea, and that's where I'm going back in June for an exhibition as well. So it's been sort of what's been keeping me busy art-wise with exhibiting.
Yeah, but you've always been, your portfolio is always spread out more than just, doing canvases and shows and exhibitions. I think first was your very unique characters as an illustrator, right, in illustrations?
Yeah, I don't quite know what I am or who I am or where I belong. But this is nothing new. This is something that I feel I've contested with for a long time, perhaps my whole career, that I create stuff that can be used commercially, that can be licensed, can be in a magazine or a newspaper or on a product. But I also paint and draw, and it can be in galleries and museums, exhibitions. And I also like to perform and do stuff live and make video and animation and music and writing. And so sometimes I do a lot of different things, and it's I think sometimes it's difficult for people to understand where I belong, because I find it difficult to understand where I belong. So for some people, yes, I'm an illustrator, and for other people I'm an artist, and for other people I'm just a deadbeat loser, and other people.
but is it important for you that there is some kind of classification? Because for me, firstly, of course, you're a person that actually managed to do something with a very unique talent, and find his own brand is probably wrong, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, like, well, that's what people say nowadays.
Yeah, but I mean, when I think of John Bergerman, and even when I thought of it before we worked together and personally met, there was, this is John Bergerman. You will recognize this everywhere, unless, of course, it's on a t-shirt in Asia and it's not yours. It's just
that does happen a lot.
That does happen a lot, right?
No, but more often than not now. It's kind of a bit weird. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not half as famous as you in regards to art, but even my stuff you can see in Asia sometimes. It's always interesting for me. It's like probably me. It's like different because I don't sell a lot of illustrations actually for money, and I don't produce any T-shirts or products that you know sort of people could rip off. So for me, it's sometimes kind of weird to see that they're actually doing. Using my work for this.
I mean all over the world, not yeah. just in Asia, this kind of stuff happens. And also what with getting older, that younger people that liked your work now start to make work in a similar way, which is really interesting to sort of see happen. So I don't need the classification. I mean, I don't know, I think these things kind of can weigh us down a little bit. I know you need a classification if you want to sell yourself for or to something, because you can't, I mean, it's, if you can't say what the product is, then how can you find the people to buy it in really crude, cold, horrible terms? So sometimes I get in a little bit, you know, like I'm a little muddled or overlooked, or people don't quite know what to do with me because I've not done a great job in explaining like explicitly what it is I do or what I am, because I don't really want to do that. I don't really want to be any one thing, and I don't want to just be stuck doing the thing that I'm known for and like being on a treadmill. I have to keep going with one thing. So it's my own fault, but it's my choice, and that's just how I am as a person. I don't think I would be very happy just doing one thing. So
yeah, I understand. So
that's what I have to live with, because I'm sure I could be a lot more successful and richer and everything if I had just stuck to say one aspect of what it is that I do.
But you know, you may think that, but I've been doing this for a long time now, and meeting many people, and there are a couple of people who are actually really strongly building their brand and really defining what they are and what they want to be, and that also doesn't work most of the time, because there's still a factor that you can't really influence yourself. You got to meet the right people to, sort of push it and move you to certain levels. And then, I mean, it's simply the difference. If I've picked you up for the gallery here in Hamburg and in Germany, we did some really nice shows. We had good fun, and I think we were successful, especially during that time. But if Larry Gagosian would have picked you up, you'd be on a completely different level within a year in terms of financial status and worldwide recognition and stuff. So you could probably live off doing 10 large paintings a year.
That would be good.
I know it would be good, but it's that's what I say. But it's like this is like, it's also about, you know, connecting to people and finding the right people and actually doing something out of it. And I think if you're trying to plan too hard, I mean, you see that a lot now that artists, I mean, everybody's trying to curate their own Facebook and Instagram streams, especially Instagram streams. And then I have this discussion a lot recently with artists and how important it is. And it is important to not necessarily share other artists and keep it to yourself and stuff like that. And then there was yesterday with somebody, I had a meeting with someone who is doing the whole social media for a large museum here in Hamburg, a large institution in Hamburg. And he was meeting one of the most important social media heads, that brains that run around this country. They were talking, and he was just basically saying, yeah, well, forget about curating your Instagram timeline. Nobody's interested anymore. And, you know, next thing is everybody's just throwing out stories, you know, it's just, and you know that Maurizio Catalan, for example, he has a beautiful Instagram timeline. He's only always posting one picture after you took the other one that was on there off, you know, there's always just one. And it's also pretty smart, you know, I mean, the people are just totally overloaded. And so I think it's very difficult to plan, especially these years. I mean, the good thing about you is you've already established yourself as John Bergerman, you know, something that somebody, yeah, exactly. That's who you are. And I think people can appreciate that.
I'm definitely glad to have had my formative years in a world without social media, for sure. And sort of have a slower, steadier, organic growth in my like practice and personality, rather than try and have a quick fix immediately, which is what I think a lot of the social media stuff kind of encourages or responds well to. But yeah, it's very overwhelming in that digital space. How does anyone see anything? Luck plays a big role, I think. There's so much talent out there. It's whether anyone can find you on it. It's a big crapshoot, as they say.
Yeah, it's difficult. But I mean, nonetheless, everybody's kind of trying and, you know, trying to get attention somewhere. I'm personally same with the gallery. I'm always, well, I think the professional term would be rethinking. I'll also write that, rethinking gallery, and the ideas and concepts behind it, because I personally don't think that there is anything stable in this business and in this art world for a long time, when you look at especially at the younger market, because it's all developing new and constantly changing anyway. And I think the galleries that can afford to remain like brick and mortar business in a way are the big ones, are the upper 1-2%, because, you know, sort of they just have the money to do that, and people with money supporting that, buying from them, the auction houses. But this is a different league. This has got nothing to do with what we're basically doing. But you're also doing a lot of projects where you actually, you know, create walls and environments and, you know, stuff like that. Is that something that you're invited to often, or is that, you know, I mean, now that there's like, I think when you did the first wall, there were probably 500 people who could do that or who would do that, and now there's like 5 million who are actually doing that, and maybe they're doing it cheaper than you. Is there a lot of, you feel the competition out there?
Yeah, I mean, I see a lot more, and it's funny. I think we see the rise of the installation or the mural or the experience very much because of Instagram and social media, because it's not enough to go and look at nice art. You have to be able to be inside it and photograph yourself, and you have to be the focal point, and you can do that if the room is a space in which the whole work encompasses. I did a lot. In fact, when I moved to New York, I was a bit burnt out doing walls. I mean, I'd been flown all over the world doing murals and things, which was brilliant, but I find it really exhausting. Like, I can paint very quickly, but it doesn't mean I can paint a wall in a you know, do a wall a day for a month or something. You're right. There's a lot more people doing it. There's a lot more demand for it. And maybe like the trick has been uncovered as well, that you don't have to be particularly good at it. That if you just do enough of it, it looks impressive. So the barrier to entry, like, things don't have to look particularly great. And then it allows just more people to do it. And yeah, maybe they do it cheaper. I don't know. But yeah, I've definitely done a lot less, I would say, in the last 10 years than I did in the 10 years before. But maybe also it's because people got tired of me, or maybe I just got too old, or I don't know. But I definitely wasn't I wasn't pushing for it. You know, I don't email people saying, can I paint on your wall? I don't think I've ever done that. So I don't think I ever really ask anyone to do anything. Like, all these things kind of, I've been very lucky they come to me, but it also means I can't complain when they don't come to me, because I don't really go out of my way to make them happen. I feel very awkward asking for stuff, and maybe that's my Britishness. So I find it very difficult. Oh, can I paint on your wall, or can I do the back of your house? Or I don't know. So I'm not very good at all that kind of stuff. So yeah, people want me to do, and people do still hit me up to do things. But yeah, my requirements for doing it are probably a little bit higher now. Like, you got to pay me well. You can't expect me to do it in one afternoon. If I have to travel far, you got to pay for all that. You know, I don't know, normal sure. stuff. Because yeah. I don't need to do it. I don't necessarily really need to do it. But even yeah. more so because of a bazillion other people drawing wonky drawings on the wall. So that box is being ticked and fulfilled, and the world has plenty of people able to do that. So maybe I'll turn my attentions to other things, other challenges.
Yeah. You're still doing sculptures? We did, yeah.
A little bit. I bought myself one of these like hot wire cutter things. You see me? Mm-hmm. You can kind of cut yeah. through foam and stuff. Yeah, yeah. I've been like tooling around with that, but it's too slow for me. Like, maybe I need to buy a more industrial thing, but I need to slice through foam as if I'm drawing a line on a piece of paper. It needs to mm-hmm. be fluid and quick. So I need to find something a little bit, yeah, a little stronger. But I've been playing around. I was making a lot of stuff out of Play-Doh a few years okay. ago, tiny little sculptures that I photographed, so they could be blown up super big, as if they were giant sculptures. So, yeah, playing around. And I still work with Louise, aka the Felt Mistress.
Who, oh, yeah.
Yeah, who makes yeah. really beautiful stuff. So we still make stuff together. She's amazing. I mean, you just send her some horrible little 2D drawings, and she kind of can totally work out how to render them in felt and plush and yeah. sew them absolutely beautifully. So still do stuff with her. Yeah.
Well, it's yeah. great you're still working with her, because I mean, her work was in the Lossy Botany Lab here, the flowers and stuff. They were beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the vegetables and things. Yeah.
yeah
She's
yeah.
amazing. She's amazing. Yeah. So yeah, still do sculptural stuff now and again. And like with some of these like Asian exhibitions, like I had one in Hong Kong last year. Yeah. They're very keen to have like sculptural forms, and it's a bit of a dream, because yeah, I can draw it out and they'll have proper teams make it. So I made these giant sort of cracked eggs last year, which were fun. And yeah, a lot of, I don't know if you, I mean, the three dimension, but like a lot of sort of 2D, like cut out stuff, like sort of what you'd imagine old movie sets would be like. So the front of something, but there's actually nothing behind it. So I like that kind of stuff as well. Do you know the kind of thing I mean? Like a,
yeah,
just like a flat cut out. As soon as you like take something off the page, off the wall or off the canvas, and it has a physical form, even if it's very shallow, it changes it completely. So I love that. I love taking my work into the real world and putting it in spaces outside of a white cube. So yeah, I've been doing a bunch of stuff like that. When I do it for myself, it's out of cardboard, obviously.
Yeah, I'm just, I've been preparing for this conversation. I've been looking on your website and your projects and stuff, and it's still really insane for me to see how much you actually draw. I mean, how much space you cover, and even if it's a small space, it's like all the details and all the tiny bits that are in there. And I think that is still pretty unique. To me. And you're mostly still working with markers, the same markers that you've been working with, I don't know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I still use
the Posca pens, and
I still yeah. use the Posca. I use yeah. Krink, I use acrylic, I use whatever I've got I can get my hands on. I've been using more spray paint recently. I've got a bit All more right. space now, so I like to use I love the Posca pens and stuff, but thing is, I'm too familiar with it. It's too easy. I've been trying to use different materials, so I'm not very good at using them, and so I will make mistakes, and so those little accidents and hiccups and things will make the work seem interesting and new to me, and therefore it might be new and interesting to others. But it's yeah, like the murals or anything. If I could rock up with some Posca pens and fill a space, and whilst that's enjoyable, it's kind of predictable to me. And that's something I really don't think is healthy as a sort of artist or just as a human being, that I kind of know exactly what I'm going to make. I close my eyes and can see it all perfectly. So I'm trying to disrupt that. So I've been trying to make works in different ways, working different materials and different surfaces, and like changing it up, like not drawing with outline and filling it in and stuff like that. And in my own way, sort of breaking out of a formula that one gets. It's something that I think we're engineered to do. We have a task. If you do it a lot, the brain wants to find the shortcuts. What's the easiest way of doing this? How can I be more efficient? Which is great if you're filling in your tax returns or vacuuming your house or something. But I think for making of art, making interesting things, it becomes problematic because predictability is boring.
Yeah. A social approach to many things. Like when you started with your Instagram stories that you've done, where you basically, maybe you can explain that better than, if I'm trying to do it now. Just what was that all about? It was also exhibited at Tate Modern, I think, or parts of it, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Funny. Insane.
Yeah. I have them. I have some of them are also in the headquarters of Instagram, and they're on their big, I've not been there in person, but on their giant screens in their reception area, some of my stories. Well, they were. I don't know if they're still there, but they commissioned me to make some, which was pretty funny to have the company like hit me up for some content for their offices. Yeah, I don't know. I try to treat it as just another tool, as a sketchbook or a little digital sketchbook in my pocket. That's what Instagram is, and that's what the stories is or was for me. As when I discovered you could draw on images, then it became really fascinating to take video and photograph and draw on top of them, particularly video. And also, as you're well aware, you do all this stuff, people can see it and they can respond to it. And there are the tools on there for people to send you back video in response to what you're doing, or messages. So this also became a material to play with. Whether it became artwork or part of my practice, I'm not quite sure. I think so, because I made so much of it. But it didn't start off like that. In the same way I'm talking about using different physical materials to make stuff, why not treat digital tools in the same way? So I put stuff out there and encourage people to respond, to make stuff in response, to even here is something that is unfinished, or here is an object or an image. I'm not even going to touch it. What can you see in this image? What can you draw on top to turn it into something? And then sharing those responses back on my feed and on the stories. It's been really fun. I've done a lot of it. I've kind of eased off in the this year, just because, again, it kind of felt like I was repeating myself a little bit. Like, I know the kind of tricks and things that brought me enjoyment, making that stuff on there, but I don't know if I can, like, unless it's, I feel like it's kind of covering new ground, I don't know why I would keep doing it. That is a problem I have. I'm sure if I kept doing it, because it got kind of, some of it, got popular. If I kept doing it, I'm sure it would have increased in popularity, and I would have got those all important likes and all important followers. I don't know. It just got a little bit boring to just keep putting eyeballs on stuff. As much as I really love putting eyeballs on stuff, and I'm not saying I won't do that in the future, it's just other stuff sort of took over, and I got interested in making different things. But it was a cool ride. I mean, I've kept pretty much all the stuff I made, so I have a huge archive of stuff from 2017 to present day, all the little videos, all the goofy little songs, all the little funny animations and stuff. So. And I will show them. I will have them in exhibitions. We'll do something with them. But yeah, I don't know. It just maybe reached a little bit of an impasse.
But I think, I mean, you all also, I think one very big aspect of your work is that you're always communicating with your audience. You do this through performances or through slipping into a character or by, you know, these Instagram stories, where you get something in return. And maybe there's a point when the discussion comes to a point where you say, okay, now almost everything's being said, you know, and it starts to repeat itself. And I think that's a point where you get, when you start getting the most traction for a project like this, but then you have to continue it. You have to go down that path hardcore. And even though you've heard all the answers and all the questions, you still have to do it. And I mean, that's the beautiful thing about being an artist, that you basically have the right to decide when it, you know, sort of when it's not helping you anymore and bringing you any further. I understand. I think what you're describing is generally just the curiosity that drives a lot of good artists. Yeah,
I think, you know, no one, I mean, I have lots of side projects. Everything is a side project. I don't want anything to sort of take over too much. So, yeah, with the social media stuff, it's good, but I don't cover being super famous on social media. And to do that, you have to put a lot of time and effort into it have that be your focus, I think. But yeah, I love interacting with people. Like, people are crazy. People are unpredictable and unusual and weird. And every single person has got something interesting to say or to share with you. And it's about how you can get that out of them. Sometimes it comes out very easily and sometimes less so. And whether it's performing, doing music, or giving a lecture, or something where there are people and you can engage with them, it's always fascinating. I never regret doing those things, even if they don't work out so well, because there's always something interesting. Because otherwise, you're just talking to yourself. You know, you're making work in a vacuum. And a lot of time being an artist is spent like that you're alone in a studio making stuff. And whilst that's good for a lot of sort of introverts like myself, once in a while, you have to push yourself out the door. And I find it really invigorating and inspiring. So it's, yeah, that's a really important part of my practice. I was having that conversation with someone a few weeks ago when I was, before I was giving a talk in Pasadena in California. And I was saying, I don't know what I am. What would you know, how would I describe myself and stuff? And they were like, you're a performer. And maybe that's the through line in all these things. Whether it's painting on a wall, that's still a performance. Mm-hmm. And then the wall is the kind of documentation of that strange little dance that you did close, you know, cheek to cheek against a wall, but with a pen in your hand. You know, there's still some sort of performance all the way through, you know, all the other stuff. So, and definitely on social media, you're talking to camera or you're sharing your thoughts. That is a performance as well. So, So I love the interaction. I think that's one of the great things that social media has brought us, that I can put my face on someone else's face in a subway in New York, and then someone sees that in Tehran and does something similar and sends it back to me, and then we have this connection. That's in the same day, in the same hour. That's crazy. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just how you use it. I mean, it fits well to what you're doing, and I think performer is a good description. Talking about descriptions, I had I've been talking to a friend of the gallery for many years, and he's also, if I send you a photo, maybe you recognize him, but he also bought, you know, drawings of yours a couple of years ago. And I told him that I'm, you know, that we do had difficulties finding the perfect meeting time for this podcast. and then he said, oh, you're doing a podcast, John. Can you maybe ask him a question that I've never dared to ask him when I was at the exhibitions? It's not that complicated. But I think it was nice, you know, because I would never phrase a question like this. But he said, you know, what, you know, with all your characters, with all the things that you do, but especially, you know, targeting your talking about your characters, is what is the world of John Bergerman? I mean, there is a world, definitely. And when he mentioned it, when he said it like this, and I said, yeah, definitely, there is a world, but I've never seen it that way. But what is your world?
That is a good question. What is my world? Well, do you mean just for the characters, or you mean me as
yeah, no, character? The characters. No, not you as a character, but the characters that you draw. I mean, when you draw like a wall with all of these characters, everything you basically draw, you kind of immerse yourself into a world. And is it our world? Is it a different world? And so that was just like, I think it was like, you know, sort of everybody relates different to characters. And what do you, where does it come from in the words of the originary nature?
Yeah, it's definitely a refraction of our world, of my life, and the people and the things that I get up to and things that I see, people I see and stuff. But it's a weird fantasy realm where I don't think there's any humans or anything in there. That's why it's a fantasy, a happy fantasy. But it's a spongy, sludgy, wobbly, malleable, fun, crazy, hyper emotional space, and all these characters are clamoring for attention and love and affection and to be heard, because that's why they're all on the wall and they're all muddled on top of each other and they're all sort of screaming and waving and trying to catch your eye. So I think it's a reflection of me and how I exist and how I see things around me and how I feel the world is, or my world at least, the spaces I exist within. And that's where they live, and they're all jumbled in there, all crammed in like a suitcase that's got too much stuff in there, and it kind of pops open and all this crap comes flying out. That's the world they live in.
Yeah, that's a good explanation, I think. So, yeah. One question that I personally have now, living in New York in a different time zone, how do you do that with following your football team?
Mm-hmm.
Lunch? It's a lunchtime, right?
It can be like first thing in the morning. So yeah. I'm a Tottenham Hotspur fan.
I know.
And
they're doing quite well.
Yeah. They've over the years they've been getting better and better. You know, we were happy just in the Gareth Bale days and Harry Redknapp and everything, but maybe even Martin Yol. But now Pochettino has done a great job. When I first moved here, I would get up very early in the morning and watch the games like it's some sort of idiot, like going to a bar for a 9 a.m. kickoff or even 7:30 kickoff, I think, and it makes you take a sort of stock of your life when it's 7:30 and people are drinking beer and you're watching your team lose and you think, what am I doing? I should be asleep, or this isn't good. So I've kind of eased off a little bit on that. I mean, I watch a lot of games, but if they're really early, it's actually quite a pleasure to wake up and find out the result rather than live through the stress. Of a game, but it puts a different spin on it. I think it's good, actually. Win or lose, you get over it a lot quicker if it's in the morning. So in the UK, play Saturday afternoon or in the evening, it would kind of ruin your night. But if Spurs lose or it's disappointing, you kind of forget about it by the afternoon. It's quite good. You get on with your day. So that's what's been going on. A year or two ago, when Spurs were neck and neck with Leicester, I got very worried we might actually win the league, and I thought, shit, I'm gonna have to fly home and celebrate with my father and brothers if we win the league. This is so ridiculous.
But I was that wouldn't have been too bad, you know.
Oh no, it would have been amazing. But I'm like, am I really gonna do this? Like, it is a once in a lifetime thing. It didn't quite happen. I'm not sure it will ever happen. But Spurs have done really, really well.
You can still win the Champions League.
That is true. That is a possibility. It's very, very unlikely, but it is stranger things have happened. We have this hope, but with so many good players injured. I just can't see it happening. And, you know, football fans will roll their eyes when I say, and we haven't signed anyone for a year. We have had no new players come in. We've spent very little money. So it's been very tough. That's good in a way. I think all football teams should all have 1 year where they say no one can buy any new players. That would be interesting. I love football, the game, but I hate football, the business. And I have friends here that I used to watch football with, and they said, no, that's enough. Done now. It's ridiculous. You know, 100 million pound players and all the corruption. You look at the World Cup and where it's going to be in a couple of years' time. It's hard to, someone trying to live ethically and soundly, to support these organizations. So, but the game itself is great, and you know
that's what
the drama. I mean, the drama it can produce is mind blowing. Look at Tottenham, Man City, this time last week.
Yeah,
insane.
Yeah, I actually saw that. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but that's not just football. That's sport in general. And if we want to look at it in a broader thing, that's just human. It's just humans, isn't it? Again, it comes down to performance and self-expression, in a way. You know, whether it's in the framed by it being a game or something, it can be amazing, right? Whether it's sport or music or art or dance or anything. I'm waffling.
But I don't want to interrupt you. But did you already? I mean, now that you're in America, so for such a long time, did you already pick up an American sports or American team that you like? I mean, is anything that could tempt you, like basketball or baseball or football?
Baseball game? Have you watched baseball?
I've
boring. Every year, it's become a kind of quasi-religious activity. And my friends find this hilarious. I host a Super Bowl party, the most un-John type thing to do. I have people. I love watching the Super Bowl. I watch the Super Bowl. And some of not this year was terrible, but a few years ago they've been really exciting. I don't have time. I always say, like, I'll get more into American football. So again, the NFL is a real heinous kind of organization full of terrible people and terrible things. So it's kind of tough. But I watch the Super Bowl once a year, and it's generally an excuse to abuse your body through processed foods and alcohol. And there's a sporting thing, you know, in the background. That's fun. Invite a lot of people over. Everyone gets excited for the halftime show. A halftime show and the adverts. This is a sport. This is an occasion where people are most excited about advertisements and which celebrities are going to be in the advertisements. So I think that tells you all you really need to know about it.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, you know, Mevin and I were big basketball fans.
Basketball, so. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
do you have an American team you follow?
Well, I'm a little bit split up, and just see what kind of. I mean, there's being a sports fan in Europe means something completely different to being a sports fan in America. I think Americans are often fans of personalities, I really love Steph Curry, and I like what the Warriors did these past years, but they just lost against the Clippers, and I loved it that they've lost, you know, because it just makes it more exciting, and there's like, you know, like there was the underdog, you know, and I think so. I'm not necessarily a fan of any team. I mean, of course, as a German, being not brought up with Detlef Schrempf and then Dirk Nowitzki, it's always the teams where these Germans played, like the Seattle Supersonics when I was young. They were really important to me, even though I could never actually see a game. And now it has completely changed, of course, but just watching Dirk Nowitzki play was just a pleasure for all these years, you know. And so of course the Dallas Mavericks will be a team that will, you know, sort of that I would still continue to follow, even though he's, you know, probably just in the administration there at some point. And yeah, but it's also, I mean, it's a very weird concept, because throughout the year, throughout the season, it's not necessarily that exciting. The playoffs, like, it's when it's getting really, really exciting.
Right, yeah.
And in football, you know, when the new season starts, you're excited from day one. You know, you're checking the standings from day one, because that mm-hmm. might actually be a chance that your team is up there, and then you sort of kind of start dreaming and hoping, and the team means something different. It's not, you know, you can't just trade off players in the middle of the season and just say, okay, these five go there, these go there, and then we'd get these guys. And then they're in the middle of the season, is a completely different team, stuff like that. I find that difficult, but I like the sports.
That happens a bit in football when some sheikh comes and buys your team. And
yeah, but that's not the team I follow. That's an aspect of football that's not really interesting to me.
I agree. It's like it's hard to keep up. It's hard to keep up with all these players coming and going of all the major teams. But it's just in my blood. I was brought up with football from day one, so it's hard.
But was it always the Spurs?
My family on my dad's side are all Spurs fans, so. He was born and raised in London, so that's where that comes from. I can't help but want to check the score, but I don't want to get emotionally distraught with it. It's so pointless to be upset, oh, you lost or you didn't win. And you're right, you check the standings, but when does it really matter? It matters at the end of the season. Where you end up is the most important. Like, we finished top, or we avoided relegation, or in the middle. But you're in that spot for the summer, and then it resets. So when did it really? Nothing ever stops, right? And it's you can never. So you can you have to enjoy the moments of victory. I guess that's what it is. It's like a metaphor for life. You never really can cash out and say I'm done, because you can only do that when you're dead, right? So it's just these moments. And I think that's the thing about sports or following a football team, not to get too upset. It will reset. It resets every year. You know, maybe you'll be in a different division or something, but really what does it really matter?
The cities and, you know, cities become villages that you go to see a game or. They only have one camera on the pitch and then at some point none. You know, how deep you're relegated. You know?
Yeah, I mean, they're important for communities, and that's where the love comes from, and that's what it's moving away from when it's like when the local communities can't afford to go to the stadiums, you know, then something is being lost. But like, you know, St. Pauli, and you know, it's you know, teams like that bring people together and are still of the people is a really wonderful thing. There's a great documentary on Netflix called Losers. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen it, but Melvin told me about it. Yeah,
there's a really great episode. I've forgotten the football team on the coast of the UK, and you know, it's will they get relegated, will they not, and what it means to that whole town.
Yeah,
you know, it's the football is all they have to look forward to, all that brings them together. And if this team gets relegated, then they go into administration and there's no more football team, then it leaves a massive black hole. So it's, you know, it's meaningful beyond just a paycheck or sponsorship deals or something. And yeah, it's really great. If you've not seen it, you should certainly check it out.
Here we have a weird season this year. We're just actually we had really good standings until now. In the last games, we all more or less lost or had draws and stuff like that. But everybody's very, very disappointed with the team, even though we're not fearing relegation or anything this year. But it's just like something's off about this season, and we kind of have to, you know, get that changed next season again. Something's off about this team. Something's off about the fans, and so I think it's you know, it's like a little bit. you know, coming of age in certain terms, young fans are getting older and taking more space in the stadium. Older fans are getting older and maybe at some points, you know, so there's discussions amongst fans that I've never experienced before. And there's a team that doesn't really want to win, you know, they're supposed to win. And I think there's a big difference if everybody says, oh, no, gotta win this game, or if you say, I'm gonna win this game, you know. So, I mean, and that's currently like it's. So we have two more games at home. Every on Saturday, there's one. All my friends that I know, we're all going there to have a nice, you know, sort of sunny day in the stadium. But nobody's actually expecting anything of this team anymore, and they have to do a lot of changes next year, or just mental changes. I don't know. But it's, you know, I mean, I've seen seasons where they played terrible and everybody loved them, and I've seen seasons where they actually, you know, sort of the standing is pretty good and it's just like it's off like this one, and you never know, as you know, as you said, it's different. But then you still, you kind of, you're super frustrated, you're starting to hate things about the whole thing, and you say, why am I going in freezing cold standing there for, you know, over 2 hours in the stadium, 2.5 hours sometimes in the stadium, the beer is freezing in your cup at 1 o'clock and afternoon, but you're still drinking and you're still singing and you're still celebrating. And next week it might be even colder, and they might not even have beer. You're still going. So, yeah, it's hard to explain.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's the church. You know, that's where you go to be with your people through thick and thin.
Yeah. So it's interesting, John. We started talking about art and stuff like that, and now we ended up on football. But I like that. I like the course this conversation took.
It's all part of the same mix. It's all,
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
So any chance that we? Well, I think we have to get you back to Germany again at some point. You haven't shown in Germany in many years, right? I mean,
no, that's true.
Some group shows.
I've been exiled over here. That's the one thing. I love living here. And it's been really great, but I do miss Europe on my doorstep. I do miss being part of Europe, or I'm gonna miss that. But it's very difficult. I get invited to do stuff in different European cities, and it's a lot harder to commit to going to do them because it's not 1 or 2 hours away. And I really hate flying, and I try not to do it all the time. So it would be nice to come back, and I like Hamburg a lot. I like Germany. Dare I say, even like the German people, which might be unusual for a British person to say. But no, I like it a lot. So yeah, I miss it. It would be nice to come back, definitely. Maybe not in the winter. But, yeah.
No, I mean, there's no use coming here in the winter. We don't even have snow anymore. It's just cold and rainy. Anyway, John. It's a pleasure talking. It was a pleasure talking to you. I really enjoyed this podcast with you, even though it took a while until we found, you know, sort of time and date and everything. And it's your morning still and my afternoon, and I'm going to go off to the opening of a brew pub now.
Very nice.
And what are you doing now? You're just starting to work, right?
Yep, I'm starting to work. This afternoon, there's a Basquiat exhibition in the city that very difficult to get a ticket for. It's free to go to, but to keep the numbers reasonable, you have to get a ticket. So I've got a ticket for that. And so I'll be going there this afternoon. It's a beautiful, warm, breezy, sunny day. Here in New York, so it's one of those days where you just feel everyone is smiling, and it feels great to be alive and all that kind of stuff. There's only like 4 or 5 days like this in New York in the whole year, and I think everyone knows that, so we try and make the most of it. But yeah, that's what I'm going to be doing. I'll be going to that, and then later tonight I'll be going to some friends do like a live comedy thing, which is I'm not sure what to expect, but I'll be going to that. So it's a busy day of fun stuff and work stuff.
Sounds good.
Yeah. it'll be good.
And start off with this podcast.
Yeah, it's been a good start. So yeah, really nice to catch up with you. Very nice to talk to you. And yeah, thanks very much for having me on.
Yeah, it's great having you.
All right, I'll speak to you another time soon.
I think I miss you. Where have the mails gone? Perhaps you're stuck in a lift or wading through a pond. Batteries all dried out, drives driven to despair. Perhaps you dropped your laptop and are waiting for the repair. I think I miss you. Ooh. I think I do. Status updates, entries are far gone. No new pictures have been uploaded, it's weeks since you logged on. Constant clicking to collect, to retrieve some communique. The button, a sorry nub, reload, refresh, replay. I think I miss you. Itching out its nips, I think I miss you.